Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
All right, well, Titus, it's kind of weird for me to have a conversation with you like this without tiki drinks at hand, but I guess we'll swing with it. I'm Matt Koulikondis. I'm here to talk with Titus Winters about software engineering at Google. And I guess I kind of want to start with just like the cover says, curated by Titus Winters, Tom Manchrek, and Hiram Wright. Like, what does curated by really mean?
So we wanted to be as upfront as we could be about the fact that many of the chapters, most of the chapters, are written by people whose names are not those three primaries. We were kind of the project leads and did the lion's share of editing and feedback for authors and all of those things. We spent a lot of time on outlines and theses and like trying to have a consistent voice across the text. But I would be absolutely false to claim that like this was all our insight or all our, you know, input. We tried to come up with an interesting, useful list of topics and then match, you know, more experienced people to those topics and then filled in the gaps ourselves where we had to.
So then like which parts of it were, when you got the chapters, were most greenfield to you? Or were you least familiar with the content of the chapters?
I would say that for me, the place that was most surprising, I'll go with that at least, was the build systems chapter, which I remember so vividly being the first time that there was a chapter outside of like, we're going to have a project here, chapters not written by any of the three main authors. Where we got a chapter that was, oh, that's how that works. Oh, I feel like I have learned so much all of a sudden. And just the writing quality and the technical depth there and the insight was just wonderful.
What do you mean? Everyone knows that a build system is just a shell script. It's God and nature intended.
So part of the reason why that's one of my favorite chapters is because that's pretty much exactly where Eric starts with it, right? Starts with walking us through the sort of natural, I got tired of this like toil work progression that leads us to most build systems. And he starts with, you know, you invoke a compiler and you get tired of that. And then you have this shell script, you know, as you said, as God intended. And then we move up a level to something a little bit more like make. And what all of this is missing, and really the thesis of the chapter that still one of my favorite things, is the idea that the next important step follows the evolution of programming languages. And what you really want is your build system to be modeling a functional language, specifically because you need it to be hyper aware of side effects and where there is state dependencies. And at the point where you have no unknown side effects, caching and parallelization and dependable builds are natural. And what I have come to take out of all of that is, if you ever have to run make clean or the equivalent for your, you know, your build system.
I mean, which level? My projects have make clean, make disk clean, and make real clean.
Right. Like, if you have to do any of those things, your build system is fundamentally bad. And increasingly when I do like customer visits and talks and consulting and stuff, and they like, if you could fix one thing in you know, tech or our technical systems, what one piece of advice would you give? I'm like, you are not going to believe me, but fundamentally fix your build system. Like, so much downstream productivity boon comes from, you don't have to question whether the build is good. You don't have to spend the time doing a fresh build. The computer knows like which parts actually need updating.
I find it interesting because the way you describe it, of, you know, you start with running the commands directly, then you have a shell script that gobbles them together, and then you have make. And like, I've been at companies where like, okay, and then we wanted to add distributed things. So you change your compiler from CC to DistCC, and you just kind of layer the hacks like deeper until at some point you need to like actually stop and re-envision this as a system. And I think that there's actually something similar that happens in version control. Where like, okay. I started with it, like I had some files, and then I made some copies of some files, and then like I have like dated zip files that I tarball periodically. Mm-hmm. And I just think the ecosystem is better, has better embraced the idea that your version control needs to be a thought out system than your build needs to be a thought out system.
Yeah, I think that that is absolutely correct. I think in the version control space, it was very obvious, like, oh, we didn't have atomic commits for multiple files at once. And we ran into problems with those race conditions. With the build system, like, and reproducibility and hermeticity sort of properties, I somehow is less obvious that that is a thing that the build system can and should be doing. And I think part of that is our conceptualization of version control sort of always implied that you could commit multiple files at once. And then when it failed, that was just an expectation violation. Whereas the magical Shangri-La of your build system just works, that it's cacheable and paralyzable and all of this stuff, that doesn't feel like a thing that we assume out of the gate. Although we really should. But I think that's what's held up the evolution gap between those two things.
Yeah, I think there's also like there's a continual monkey knife fight between your build system and your language dependency graph. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a whole chapter on dependencies that I promise someday I'll read. But like, can you speak about how language level dependencies and build systems interact?
If we accept the model that your build should be hermetic and should be reproducible, this is very good for the organization as a whole, like because you stop having the discussion of, well, it worked on my machine. Like there is a ground truth, and also most people are going to experience the ground truth by default.
For a moment, let's pretend I'm as dumb as you think I am. And can you define hermeticity?
Having no external dependencies that aren't tracked by the build system and your version control system. And so one of the ways that we violate that all the time now is in just the dev model for shared libraries, for instance. Go to a Linux distribution model, right? If you have headers and .sos installed and the product that you're working on depends on those, right, you're deeply not hermetic, right? The particular patch version of those installed libraries might be different on your machine versus on the CI server versus on your office mate's machine.
Right. This is the sort of thing we use Docker virtual env and stuff for.
Right. Exactly. Part of our sort of conceptualization and usage of most programming languages is where do you pick up sort of ambiently installed packages? And that is a distinct and direct tension with having more hermetic builds. It's a habit that I think we kind of have to learn to break. Like having developer packages installed on your machine was valuable for hobby stuff and when you're not really coordinating with a lot of other people. But one of the things that we do have to sort of give up is, yeah, it can't just be whatever you happen to have laying around. Like we need to actually have a bill of materials. We have to understand what the ground truth of what is part of the build.
Right. You're espousing the heresy that I should be able to update the OS on my dev machine without updating all of the versions associated with my build.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
This is definitely a heresy that I would espouse. Yeah.
So there's an interesting hermeticity, like, is this sort of recurring theme that comes out of this. And I think it plays interestingly in testing. And I was hoping to tease a little bit more out of testing about this and, like, where hermeticity breaks down in testing.
If you look at pretty much any published description of, like, what are the properties that your tests should have, hermeticity shows up in this list, right? And this is largely because it's very easy to run into situations where only one person in the organization can run the tests at a time because you have dependence on some shared state.
Well, that's the QA engineer.
Database, right. And like, this is going to be a scaling problem, y'all. And the more that we can get our, especially unit tests, to be more hermetic, the more they are not being, our results from those tests are not being affected by stuff outside of what we understand to be being tested, right? The system under test is much more controlled. As you sort of expand out from the unit test environment into more of an integration test regime, then you have to draw different boundaries on what is the system under test is the terminology we tend to use. And there will probably come a point in that scale where it can't be entirely hermetic and isn't valuable to be hermetic anymore, even. If you need, you know, a production ML model or something to get end-to-end results on, is this feature working? Having the system drawn with such tight boundaries that you don't have access to that model doesn't really give you faith that your end-to-end test is working anymore, right? And so increasingly, like, I hear arguments on both sides of we shouldn't have unit tests because they're going to miss things. They don't have high enough fidelity. We should just rely on those integration tests and end-to-end tests. Or the end-to-end tests, the integration tests are too expensive. We can't possibly, like, use only that. And both of these arguments are true. Fundamentally, like, there needs to be defense in depth and kind of a gradient in there. I like looking at it these days as, what's the cheapest mechanism you can find to reliably prevent against that class of bugs for whatever thing is bothering you at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of have a hot take about integration tests, which are, integration tests are the uncanny valley of tests. They look like tests, they act like tests, but they're not, and they just cause pain.
It's yes and no. Like,
so you hit me with no, because I'm convinced of yes.
In a perfect world, I think it's much more justifiable that we need unit tests. And I tend to recommend to groups, start with unit tests until they're not giving you enough faith, enough safety net, enough fidelity to predict your downstream problems. And then on the extreme other end of it, for like release qualification and running canaries, like I have a potential update to my release that I want to evaluate, right? That's effectively an end-to-end test in a slightly different coat. But in between there are definitely things that you can do that are much cheaper than that release qualification canary end-to-end sort of thing, but are distinctly not as hermetic and fast and single process as you would hope for from a unit test. And it varies from project to project and domain to domain, like, at what point do you need to reach for that? And like, how expensive are those things going to be?
So I actually want to push on this a little bit, because I have this like kind of vague theory that basically everything we get, we push on it only after we've already hit the point where we should have been pushing on it. And we have to re-envision a thing as a system. Like we did that with our build system. We kind of did that with our unit tests. And at the moment when people reach for integration tests, they would have been better off reaching for CI, for CD, continuous delivery and continuous rollback sorts of things.
I don't think that there's natural law here.
I'm kind of ignoring cars and aircraft and things that have to work.
There's a talk that I caught internally, and I don't think that there's an external version of it, but the idea holds that the absolute highest value thing that you can do for proving that your release is good is canary. This is not shocking, right? This is the highest fidelity thing you can do.
Only if you could understand the metrics of releases.
Sure. But I would certainly argue that if you can achieve the strategic outcome of I can run Canary every few hours safely, and it's not going to actually harm live users. That is, I can't think of a better strategic footing to be on, right? And if you are in that state, then you could imagine maybe stepping away from your commitment to integration tests. But I suspect that even then, you're going to find classes of things that could have been caught earlier and cheaper. And if that is the case, then you still need integration tests. The other place that integration tests had come up that is really valuable is sort of the exploratory, not CI use case. Like, I'm making a change to search. I need to spin up a little, indexing backend and a little front end piece and a little other thing, right? And if those can scale down so that you can just run them locally on your desktop, and use that as the system under test while you poke and prod and reboot your particular piece of it, that's a vastly better development experience than having to wait until the next scheduled integration, full system integration test, especially if those are being shared across the team and you're not going to get, hermetic results. There's the word again, hermetic results. And so even if you're idea of integration tests would be better off replaced strategically by continuous delivery and good canary and all of that stuff is true, which it might be, having the additional use case affordance of this improves developer experience, gives you better cycle times on real seeming systems, still integration testing.
Yeah, I think you actually flirted into an interesting area there of performance, right? Let's put aside correctness and talk about I'm an engineer whose job is to make it fly. And how do I keep that loop tight enough, but believable enough? And I think you're right there. Something more like an integration test is, although, man, I love in certain circumstances, I've had to you bring up a cluster where the even numbers have something and the odd numbers have something else. If you do an A/B test.
Yeah, I think that our whole approach to continuous delivery and continuous integration and experimentation and building local system under test for manual testing and development work, I think that this is still a space where there's a lot of room for codifying a few good ideas that are out there, but I don't think that we're consistently all on the same page on that stuff.
So I'm going to draw the technical side to a close for a moment. We'll probably come back to it, but awesome. The book is Software Engineering at Google. Which of these things do you think Google stands to improve the most? Where is it furthest from the city on a hill?
I think a lot of the culture chapters are a little bit aspirational.
No, not culture. We'll get to go to culture. First, I want the technical.
You just want the technical. Some of the ideas in the testing chapters are a little bit aspirational. But I think by far the biggest gap between this is what we think we understand and this is how stuff is currently actually operating is almost certainly the dependency management chapter. That chapter gave me literal nightmares. I cannot express how challenging that particular piece was. And most of that really boils down to there's just not great answers here. we have a lot of ideas of things that we don't think scale or that we don't think work well or that are just going to be terrible high toil. But what we don't have is a proposal for what does work and is cheap and is intuitive and scales nicely. We're starting to take some steps towards being a little better on some of that management front, but fundamentally, like the guidance that I have, forget which of those chapters it is, but it's largely prefer any number of version control problems over a single dependency management problem. And if you have lost track of what is this depending on, what version is this pinned on, do I have choices in which version to use, we've lost coordination between these things. It may not sound like that is a huge cost, but especially when you start to iterate on that, that is a just absolutely deadly cost.
Fascinating. I actually expected, and I believe the answer there is continuous deployment. Like, I kind of think Google is emerging from, like, it's at the very beginning of the Renaissance. Like, you have some people and some projects that are doing really well, and you have some others that are just like, my peasants can toil in the fields.
Yes, that is also, I think, a valid approach. I have increasingly been, I love the research that DORA does, the DevOps Research Association, which feels a little bit more self-serving because we acquired them a while back. Sadly, I don't interact with them enough. They don't publish internally enough. I've seen more of their stuff externally than internally. So
this is a different organization than the one that Sierra Jasmine wrote a chapter on?
Yeah, DORA wrote Accelerate and the State of DevOps Reports. DORA's model has been externally focused surveys across the industry of teams looking for what are your technical practices, what are your outcomes. And so DORA gives us the statistical evidence, sometimes causal, not just correlative, that practices like trunk-based development and focusing on your documentation quality lead to good technical outcomes. And one of their major drumbeats for a long time has been continuous delivery. And it's, I think, specifically because when you are strategically capable of putting out a release on a couple hours or daily sort of basis, that means that you have your automation system in hand, your tests are of sufficient quality and sufficiently fast to predict the quality of your release. Like the technical excellence level required to get there takes care of most of the quality problems. And then in return, you get the ability to move fast, run experiments quickly, get feedback from actual users quickly, resolve issues quickly. You stop having to have release branches and cherry picks because just spin another one, who cares, right? Like all of this stuff just simplifies. And to your point of where do we fail? I would be thrilled to figure out how to get team leads and directors and things all of the company to set continuous delivery targets. Because what we find very regularly, unsurprisingly, is like the directors and people above aren't close enough to the code to know like what are the things that are like slowing us down tactically.
Yeah.
And so they don't put out like, hey, team, I need you to go fix your flaky tests. Go update this dependency, whatever. Like those things are not going to happen. And the TLs, the team leads, tend to be a little nervous because we don't entirely tell them what they have authority and control over when they take on the TL role. And so they focus on feature stuff, which is good. It's important. That's how you bring value. Right? But I think that maybe the missing piece is if we get the directors to set continuous delivery targets, quality targets, then you get the results that they do actually care about without them having to know the details. And the team leads have the permission to tackle the tactical things that they know are bothering them. Yeah. I think that would be a great result.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. You mentioned documentation, and I'm actually going to take that as a moment to shift about, you know, some of the CD, like you mentioned, a culture of excellence. I'm going to take that moment to shift into the topic of culture. Yeah, like all good engineers, I've accidentally skipped culture. And yeah, the first, I don't know, like five chapters of the book are just about these annoying, squishy culture things. why?
We have known for at least 50 years that software engineering is about two things. It's time and people. There's a Dave Parnas quote that I utter far too often. It's probably Dave Parnas, that software engineering is the multi-person construction of multi-version programs, right? Going back to the early 70s, we know that it's about time and people. And it's obvious from the start that you can't ignore the programming aspect of all of this. And unfortunately, we train all of our undergrads effectively in individual programming tasks,
right?
In order to get a grade, you're taught individually. And in order to learn to program, you do that individually. It's completely natural that we're doing that. But that changes immediately upon actually joining a team. Like, it's not an individual thing. It's a team sport. And I certainly wasn't told that in those, you know, uncertain terms when I joined up any of the jobs that I've had. And when you recognize that, oh, yeah, I need to, it is a productivity hindrance to be a jerk. It is a productivity boon in the long term to be helpful and mentor people and all of the above. I think those are essential.
So I've been on a variety of teams. I've been on a handful of teams at Google, like four. I've been at some startups beforehand. And I've at least one of those teams followed in your wake, Titus. And it had just a palpably different culture than everywhere else I've been. Everyone was engaged and friendly and just like part of a team in a way that I never had elsewhere. What's the cheat code? How do I build that?
I don't have a cheat code for that. Like, it does take time. It does take energy. It does take effort. It's an active process. There's a handful of things that I think contribute to it. And there's certainly more on this in the leadership chapters in the book. One of the things that has worked for me personally is to be very upfront about, no, I don't know. No, it's okay for me to be wrong. Like, I will be wrong on stuff. And I rely on everyone, the more junior people included, to tell me when I'm wrong or to like make me do the math. When I was serving in the C++ Standards Committee, I was chairing the subcommittee for the design of the standard library. And one of the things that I focused on there very aggressively was asking dumb questions. And like, I refused to let the room start taking votes on like design topics until I felt like everyone in the room had relearned the material sufficiently to take an informed vote. And in order to do that, I had to ask a lot of dumb questions, some of which I was faking and some of which I wasn't, because this is a very complicated domain, right? But like, when you model that it is okay to not know things and you set the flavor of those discussions to be kind of a teaching educational bent, the individual discussion is probably going to get to a better result. And you have invested in growth for everyone that is participating. And that longer term investment in growth through education and learning and discussion and it being okay to be wrong, that's essential, I think.
I think there's actually something really interesting there, because not only is it okay to be wrong, like guaranteed you will be wrong at some point or another. Like, the thing that SRE has taught us in life is that 100% is not an SLO. Like, right. Everything has an error margin, including your correctness.
Yep.
And thus change is the necessary outcome of this, right? You need to be able to, when you learn you were wrong, change.
Absolutely. I think it's actually indicative of the major difference in understanding of software engineering and project management that we've seen in the last, you know, 10, 20, 50 years. If you go back to Fred Brooks and the Mythical Man Month essays, he has this nonsense to us about the surgical team, right? Where the whole notion of how you structure your teams and your projects is, well, you find the one dude that's like rockstar, amazing, 10x, and you organize the whole rest of the team so that that person has the most focus time to like manage everything else. And that makes sense only in the domain where you're going to do exactly one project and you're trying to get that done as fast as possible. That's not how tech works, right? Like, your team is going to do multiple projects. People are going to shift around, right? It's a career event.
Yeah.
And so the model instead, it's the difference between prisoner's dilemma and iterated prisoner's dilemma, right? Like,
that should be the subtitle for the book. Moving software engineering from prisoner's dilemma to an iterated prisoner's dilemma.
Right. But so the model that I think is much better to espouse is, it's not the best person should do this task. It's the most junior person that can do this with a moderate amount of oversight, right? Because that's when it's going to get done and the team is going to grow. And the people that might have been the only ones that could do it on paper have space to tackle the next impossible thing.
Yeah. I think this also came out of an era, like back in the 60s or 70s, like one person could hold most of the components of a system in their head. Right. I always tell new people on teams that I'm on, like, in the past, one person could write software. And we're out of that era. All the software that could feasibly be written by a single person has been written.
Yep. Strong agree.
So one of the things, you know, we've talked about culture a little bit, but you started to answer culture was one of the spots where Google has the most to improve. So I want to go back to that. Where in this culture world does Google have the most to improve?
I think it's kind of all over. There's pieces in the culture chapters that focus on just how to be on a team, which is very near and dear to my heart. Like, this is, I care a lot about the gap between undergraduate education and then what do you do as a new hire in industry? And there's a lot that we're just not able to cover. It's not even I don't even blame the academic world. Like, it's just not sensible to try to cover that material in a classroom setting. But there's a lot of table stakes sort of activity that is just missing from that. Your job really needs to be ask a lot of questions. I was doing a guest lecture for a software engineering class yesterday, and this came up. And my point was, as an undergrad, you spend, you know, a week or two on an assignment, and if you're super stumped, you wait a day or two and you go to office hours and you get like a question answered. And most of the time, your code is unwitnessed by anybody. And then when you join a big company and you're trying to be successful here, you are valuable specifically because you are fresh eyes.
We call that the golden idiot at the startup I worked at.
Right. Like, you have fresh perspective. You are not cursed by the curse of knowledge, right? And so when the team has their playbook, their onboarding, their how does the system actually work, right? You are the perfect test case for all of that. So on top of, you need to get out of the habit of wait until it's perfect before you get any feedback. Everything that is causing you any stumbling is actually useful feedback to the rest of the team on, like, hey, this doesn't make sense yet.
Yeah.
And yeah, so even starting from how to be on a team, like, we could be clearer about all of that. And I wish that our onboarding was updated along those lines a little bit.
All right. So this next question is kind of a back shot, and half the reason I'm doing it is just to watch your face as I do this.
Great.
A thing you told me a long time ago was you got to put down the rubber ducky to learn to play the saxophone. Can you first describe what that's a reference to?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Really? Oh.
This doesn't even sound like a phrase of mine.
It is, and you've spun this about on me to make me describe it. It's from Sesame Street. Bert or Ernie, I forget who, wants to learn to play the saxophone, but he refuses to put down his rubber duck, so he can't do the fingering on the saxophone. And there's a whole number about it. I swear to God, you were the person who told me this.
It's vaguely plausible, but I don't think so.
Search for it on YouTube. Anyway, it's this powerful allegory of,
yeah,
like, you have to, like, in order to grow into something harder, you have to put down the things that make you feel comfortable.
Yes.
And I feel like the chapter on leadership and sort of tries to hit that with Always Be Leaving, but isn't quite evocative enough in doing it.
I could agree with that, I think. I think it's very easy to take a blanket statement like always be leaving as just have an exit strategy, like have a plan to leave before your mistakes catch up with you. And that shouldn't be the goal, right? The putting down the rubber ducky is kind of a better metaphor in that sense. Sesame Street unpacking notwithstanding. And I think specifically because, like, yeah, you need to leave room for others to be growing. And in order to do that, you're probably going to have to go tackle something that you can't yet. And those exits are scary.
Yeah. And I think an anti-pattern I've seen from some leaders that I'm not going to name at this moment is that they leave the project, but they try to puppet it from beyond the grave or beyond leaving it.
And, right.
And I always tell people that, like, if someone is making an incorrect choice, to overrule them, you need the cost of the mistake to be higher than the cost of the, like, lessons and the blow to that person of being overruled.
Yep, absolutely. I have said many times, I regard, because I said so, or like I overrule you or disagree and commit, like those are failures in leadership in one way or another, right? I'm not going to argue that we have to have a completely consensus-driven decision-making culture, etc., right? Like there are times when you are the owner, authority, decision maker, etc., and having unanimity amongst the governed is not the right choice, right? That's not going to help. But if there is meaningful contention between, you know, you as a team lead and someone that's designing a new system or implementing a new thing, just falling back on, because I'm in charge, you need to do it this way, that's a total failure. Yeah. And that's related to all of that specifically because if you've delegated, you better delegate, right? You have to trust that the other people will be capable of doing the thing. And if they're not capable of it because they're missing a piece, explain it, right? You should be able to lead them to that change in decision-making. Putting your foot down is occasionally necessary. It's power that you want to keep in your back pocket, but should be avoided strongly.
There's a mistake I've made where I'm like, oh, I have a junior engineer who's hungry to grow, and I give them a project that's slightly too big, and then I look away, and like 6 months later, they're still just like drowning. Like, oh God, what have I done? Like, how do you balance that tension?
I think you need to go, it goes back to the psychological safety pieces that we were talking about earlier. That you need to make it clear that asking questions and asking for help and being wrong is acceptable and encouraged. And once you have, like, if you have that as a basis, then it is much more palatable to do the leadership thing and check in, like, hey, how is this going? Like, do you need anything? How can I help? Et cetera, right? Try to make that not a, I'm looking over your shoulder.
Right.
But a resource to be relied on. And even if you just have to fall back to, can you walk me through it so that they rubber duck it, to use a different form of the rubber duck analogy.
They're so versatile.
That's important. If you can even just get them to explain, like, what is going on, what is bothering them, like, what the current holdups are with enough depth, sometimes just delivering those updates triggers, oh, I need to be doing this instead.
Yeah. So you've mentioned, like, being wrong and correcting. Unfortunately, the book is now published. Like, it is a dead tree.
True.
Hopefully there'll be another version where you can correct some of the things in it or improve some of the things. Like, what chapter do you think is missing entirely?
The three that were proposed that were interesting that we never quite got traction on. There was at one point likely going to be a chapter on application frameworks and their role in productivity, efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. It's a little bit of a fraught subject.
So when you say application frameworks, you mean like Ruby on Rails level of like scaffolding around your project?
Yeah, effectively. Like the frameworks where most of the serving machinery is sort of handled centrally and behind the scenes. And like you don't need to touch all of the fiddly bits. You could, but you probably shouldn't. And the inversion of control is kind of an important part of that, right? You're not controlling main. You are defining a handler for some incoming RPC request or web request or whatever, whatnot. And those increasingly I see as a very useful mechanism to take away the sort of fiddly control that most teams probably don't have the expertise to be working with and certainly aren't going to keep actively maintained.
This is the popcorn button.
This is the popcorn button to go to.
Now that I've said that, can you expand on what it means?
Yeah, there's a talk I did at CPPCon last year on configuration and extensibility and how that runs up against maintenance concerns. And in there, we talk about configuration based on intent is very maintainable and very powerful, right? If you say, here's my system, I need to prioritize, keep memory cost down. That is a much easier thing to work with over a longer time period than say, how big is this buffer? Like, yeah. I don't know if you chose that buffer size intentionally or just randomly.
I mean, clearly there's a comment on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clearly there's a comment. Yeah. So one of the chapters that got cut was the application framework thing. And I think that there's a lot of insight to be extracted there. I think that we could go back and revitalize that. There was attempt to have a chapter on issue tracking, and it turned out we couldn't find anyone to say anything intelligent about it.
That's because all of them are bad.
Yeah, among other things.
Right, like issue tracking is like wikis. It's just where information goes to die.
Yep, kind of. And I believe that there are people that actually have like a philosophy around this that is useful and actionable and makes sense. And none of them wanted to write a chapter.
I just don't believe you.
I might be optimistic, but yeah. And then the last, there was some discussion about design, but I think fundamentally design is such a huge topic that it probably deserves to be its own book. I'm not volunteering for that.
I have been told that I have pretty good design intuition, and I've tried to articulate it, and I just can't. Right? I ended up like chatting with someone earlier today, being like, man, I really wish I didn't sound like such a bad person when I was like, oh, you should decouple these concerns, except when I tell you you should couple them.
Yeah. I have similarly questioned whether design can really be taught, but recently I've been spending more sort of classroom style time with George Fairbanks, who has books on design, Just Enough Software Design, Just Enough Software Architecture. I'm missing the title all of a sudden. There are aspects of this that I think are very teachable, and there are concepts not about how to make an individual design decision, but how to think about making design decisions that I think are transmissible.
One of the big lessons I've learned in design over my career from actually you and Sanjay has been very much like if presented two choices and one of them is very easy to undo and one of them is very hard to undo, make the easy to undo choice.
Yes, yes, yes. Chapter one, we talk about sustainability. Right. Over the expected lifespan of your code, you need to be capable of changing everything important that comes along. You don't have to do it, but you do need to be capable. And when we make decisions that can't be undone, oh, dear Lord, that is the stressor.
So what decisions can't be undone or are disproportionately expensive to undo?
Don't ship things without version numbers. It's just going to like we'll just sit there. It's a design thing. It's a maintenance thing. Just put a version number on it. Like, life is so much better.
Yeah. So I'm the lead for Protobuf, which, for people who don't know, is the serialization format that basically everything at Google is kept in. And like, man, when the world gets stored on disk, your life just gets so many orders of magnitude harder. Mm-hmm. But even across the network adds one layer of like pain because you have to deal with skew between them. But like disks are forever.
Yep. unbounded time skew. That's a terrifying thought. There's an old file storage format that our team used to maintain. I think we've both wandered off a little bit, where one of the scariest things that I've seen is a comment from circa 2008, I think, that's doing checksum validation. This is just like a serialization format. It's not really a big deal. But the thing in there that says, if the checksum validates or it's this weird bit pattern, then accept the checksum. And it has a comment on it saying, for 4 days back in 2005 or whatever time, wherever it was, there was a bug and we were always writing this bit pattern. And we have no idea if all of those records have been like expunged. So that extra branch will be there forever.
Like, I'm going to push back. Why? Like, can't we add monitoring to that branch path?
We could. Like, it's probably not worth it. Like, the maintenance cost and the, you know, it is technically feasible to undo this. It's real hard.
Fair enough. So rubber ducks have come up a fair amount, and it seemed like you boned the chance for the rubber duck to be the logo. Why a flamingo?
Amusingly, the behavior these days, I think O'Reilly just, their editors just pick a thing. I had no notion that flamingo was going to be it until I saw a completed book cover.
Okay.
I think Tom Mantrick might have had some advanced warning. He was working more closely with the publisher. But as near as I can tell, we had little to no input on choice of animal.
So I also have to ask, like, Titus Winters, Tom Mantrick, Hiram, do you just pick the curators for, like, name impact? Like, those are some hefty names.
Our parents, thank you for the feedback, I guess.
Right. There's no, like, Rob Smith on here.
No. No, this is a bunch of fairly recognizable names. We all cut our teeth on C++ core libraries early days, like 2011, we were all working together. And we've spread out over the years. But one of the major reasons that I was willing to take the spicy approach that, hey, I think we're qualified to write this, was specifically that we had seen everyone else's code by virtue of maintaining very low level stuff and having to refactor everyone else's code as we were trying to clean things up.
Oh man, I wish we had more time actually, because refactoring and LSCs are the part that I find most fascinating in this book. And I think are the part that are most foreign to other people.
Yeah, that is certainly the feedback that we've gotten is a lot of it is, hey, that's a lot of overhead. And hey, it sure does sound nice that you have all of these tests, but that seems like a lot of investment. And then you get to the chapter on large scale changes in particular. You're like, oh, wait, what? You can do what now?
Yeah.
And that is just such a mind-blowing thing. Like, oh, all of the rest of this serves for that end.
Right.
Like, we need the capability of making changes to everything. And fundamentally, most of the rest of the book is building the capacity to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's where I came up under you very heavily in the LSC space. And so to a large extent, like, it's just the water we swim in. I've almost forgotten to think about it. But I see echoes of this in, like, Rust editions or Carbons, like, whatever they're calling Carbon. Yeah. And I want to live in a world where the open source things also do this.
Yeah. That is a tall order.
I mean, can you get off your laurels and do it for me?
No. And for several reasons. Like, one, there's no coordination, of course. And so open source is, you know, loose federation of projects. But I also had a discussion about trying to build large scale changes for the Python packages on GitHub or some such. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago. And my questions to the person that was trying to do this were of the form, like, is there enough build system consistency? Is there enough test consistency to know that, like, your patches apply cleanly and, like, that the code is still working? And they said, no, 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 you don't need that. You just apply the change. You send the pull request and you apply the change. Most of the packages are broken at head anyway. And I was like, Okay. Yeah, I have no idea how to start such a task if that's the environment that we're living in. Like, keep trunk green, yo.
You could take a page out of my book, right? Like, the twist table migration across Google is you just throw the changes out there and whatever sticks, sticks. And you just keep throwing it until you've got coverage.
Right.
It was disturbingly effective.
It is amazing that you made that work.
Given that the Flamingo clearly is an accident, given the Flamingo is not a thing you control, I guess the infinity sign on it is not this like deep-seated homage to future and change.
Nope, it's certainly not. Just a happy accident.
I was really hoping it's like the arrow in the FedEx logo where like some 12-dimensional genius put that in there to subconsciously influence everyone.
Nope. Nope.
All right. Well, I'm actually going to close this interview by stealing Ezra Klein's final question, because why would I come up with my own ideas when I can steal other people's? So what are three books that have influenced the way you think? And you can't name your own.
Looking at my bookshelf when you foreshadowed that you would probably ask this, the first thing that I would surface is Just Work by Kim Scott, which is probably the biggest shift in being able to explain my, you know, thoughts and position on equity and inclusion and the value of diversity. And like, please just be cool, be nice, don't, you know, harass people. We just want to get the work done. And when those things go wrong, what do you do? Right. And I thought that that was great. I don't know if it influenced the way that I think, but I influenced a lot of what I think about Accelerate by Gene Kim and Nicole Forsgren, the DORA research.
Yeah, you mentioned them.
It's 5 years old at this point. I think the studies have only made those results more extreme. But as a citation, boy, I go to that all the time. That's just completely valuable. And then I guess philosophically, there's some Douglas Hofstadter in my background, some Gödel, Escher, Bach, but maybe more specifically his book on translation, I think, kind of the meaning of meaning is big.
In the space of philosophy, actually, you should check out Alistair McIntyre's After Virtue. I think it actually interacts really tightly with culture and how the necessity of communication forces morality.
All right.
And I'd love to squeeze in, because I personally have gotten a lot of fiction recommendations from you that I've really enjoyed. Can you give me three fiction books?
The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin, the whole Dandelion Dynasty series from Ken Liu is just rocking my world. I'm finishing book four right now. And I'm a big fan of, let's go with the Wayfarers series. It starts with The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet.
All right.
I love the expansion of sci-fi into being like more humanist. It's really just feelings and people are good.
Awesome. Well, thanks. This has been fun. I had fun.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll get to troll you more in the future.
I'm sure. Thanks all.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.